Basically, this new assignment is to repeat what we did for vacuum polarization for scalar electrodynamics. The same theory you did the three-level thing with in the last assignment, but now just do the one-loop thing to show that you're getting something which is proportional to q mu, q nu minus q squared a to mu nu, and to set up everything in dimensional regularization. Everything's always a little bit easier in the scalar case. Okay. Any questions before we get going? So we're doing everything in this QED still. So we've got minus 1/4. F nu. D mu psi, that's partial mu psi. And in general, it would be minus I, the charge, times A mu psi. For QED, the charge, we normally take to be minus E, because we're thinking of electrons. So we would write this as being partial mu psi plus I E mu psi. And so we have the final rules are, for the vertex, we have basically, if you have little arrows following fermion number, because there's a conserved charge for the fermions. Then if we have, let me actually write it the other way. We draw the fermion number going that way. Then the labels of the vertex there would be a label on Dirac space, which I'm going to call M and M. And then there's a label in the gauge space. And the Feynman rule here would have been, if we take the I times 2 pi to the fourth for every vertex, and then for this particular vertex, we have a minus sign here in the derivative. The derivative then feeds into this, so we have a minus I times E is the factor that we have here. And then we have a gamma matrix because the D slash means gamma mu d mu. And the convention is, the reason I'm being careful about the direction of the fermion number is that if you work backwards along the fermion flow, then we the matrices, so the indices M and N and mu are being carried by the gamma matrix. And of course, then the order makes a difference, and the order that you get from extracting the creation annihilation operators from that vertex boils down to the statement that if you work backwards along, if you follow a fermion line in the opposite direction from the flow of fermion number, then the Dirac matrix indices come in that order. And then the propagators. There was a similar statement for the propagators. I'm just reminding you this because I'm going to use this in a second. So if we had a fermion propagator, if we have MN, this corresponded to I over 2 pi to the fourth times, imagine the momentum flowing in the direction of fermion number, minus I P slash plus M over P squared plus M squared minus I epsilon. And this, remember, is a matrix in Dirac space. So this is MN. And again, I'm working my way backwards along the fermion flow. And the gauge boson propagator was a similar thing, which this will become much more explicit when I do the path integral story, but it's minus I, 2 pi to the fourth. And I have that. And 1 over, so we have, unlike the fermions, this is everything here is even under k goes to minus k. So you're not, the direction of the k isn't so important. And then there's a piece which depends on how you choose your gauge. So I'll just write it as alpha mu k mu plus alpha mu mu. And part of the story of quantum electrodynamics is you show that this part actually cancels out at all. Making a lot of noise over there in Guelph, so good if you tone it down.
I just got here. The other guys are held up because they stopped running the buses.
Okay.
Due to the weather.
Okay.
So they might be coming later.
Okay. All that's happened so far is I've handed out the second assignment, which I'll put on the webpage again like the old one.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. And we have a TA. Once we get over to the right-hand board here, we have a TA for the course whose email is on the board. So if you find that you can't see the board, if you say something, then I can say something too, and then the people who are...
I can't see the right-hand board you were just moving over there towards.
Is the camera follow me if I go over there?
No. It's just staying on the propagators.
Okay. So whoever's running the camera, if you could show a zoom to this the TA address, that would be useful so that the people in Guelph can write it down. But if you should find that for some reason you can't see the board, if you let me know, then I can pass it on to them in real time, the people that are running the cameras.
Okay.
Okay, so there's a story here which we can come back to where there's terms like this in the propagator which, for all intents and purposes, drop out of physical things. So the main message you need to get here is that the propagators for the fermions for large momenta, we're going to be interested in which kinds of graphs diverge and which ones don't. So we're going to be interested to know how things behave for large momenta. And morally speaking, the fermion momentum, fermion propagators are going like 1 over 1 power momentum for large momentum. And the bosonic ones are going like 1 over 2 powers, given that this is dropping out. The I epsilon, you remember, is the thing that enforces the Feynman boundary conditions. That's something which is the thing that's making sure that all the poles in the frequency plane are in the those two quadrants, and so allowed us to rotate, which rotate in these directions. Okay, so that's all preamble. So now what I'd like to do we looked at a particular graph for the vacuum polarization. Let's just take a generic graph and ask two things. One is we want to follow, in perturbation theory, what we're doing is we're taking the, we're doing something slightly wrong, and so I want to come back to this in a second, but let me make it explicit here. What we're doing is we're taking the Lagrangian, and we're writing it as an unperturbed and a perturbed part, and the unperturbed part we've been taking to be the quadratic part of the Lagrangian, so minus 1/4 fu nu minus psi bar e slash plus m psi. And the interaction part we've been taking implicitly to be minus I e psi bar a slash psi. This is quadratic. This is the cubic. Now, there's something slightly wrong with doing this because, and I'll come back to this in a bit later on, because when you do this kind of a split in perturbation theory, you know, what you're doing when you're doing some scattering calculation is that you, I'll write this on this board that we don't need to access very often. You know, typical scattering calculation, if we've been doing classical scattering, there's some region where something happens, some particle comes in, it has some trajectory, and it does something interesting. And scattering is basically the statement that at late times and at early times, the interactions were important, and so things are moving basically like free particles in straight lines. So this would be the straight part, the free particle that looks like the one in the past, and this is the free particle that looks like the one in the future. And then in the end of the day, you say, I made a transition from a particle that was moving like this to a particle that was moving like this, and the S matrix or the scattering amplitude is telling you the likelihood of that as a function of the angle change that you went through. But the whole story is designed so that in the remote past and the remote future, the full evolution is being well described by the unperturbed evolution. And implicit in that is that the spectrum of the, so in quantum mechanically, you'd say that, you know, at late times and early times, e to the minus I unperturbed Hamiltonian times time is effectively the same thing as the full evolution for t very, very large, or for t very, very small. And for this to happen, what's implicitly, one of the things you're implicitly assuming is that the spectrum of the free Hamiltonian is agreeing with the spectrum, the single particle spectrum of the full Hamiltonian in these asymptotic regions. But part of that statement is that the mass that you use to describe the free particle at infinity is the right mass. And one of the things we saw with this vacuum polarization graph is that radiative corrections, like graphs like this for the electron, or graphs like this for the photon, can change what the mass of the particle is, or it can change, interactions can change what you thought the mass was. So whereas you might have thought that this parameter here in the Lagrangian is describing the mass of the electron, really, if you do the full calculation, corrections like this are going to change the physical mass to be this parameter plus things that are suppressed by powers of E squared. And so this parameter M, once we include radiative corrections, is not exactly the mass. It's something which is parameterizing the mass, but it's not equal to the mass. And so for this whole story, what we should be really doing is being sure that the mass that we put in to this unperturbed Lagrangian is the physical, honest-to-God mass at the end of the day that the thing really moves. And so we're going to have to come back and think of the real mass as being, I'll call this thing in the Lagrangian now M-naught. Real mass will be M-naught plus some correction, which we can calculate order by order in perturbation theory through graphs like this. And what we should do is we should be sure to put only M here, not M naught. And the difference between them we should put into the interaction term. Because otherwise, we're not really properly capturing the fact that the full evolution is agreeing with the what we're calling the unperturbed evolution. So we're going to have to come back and reorganize our perturbation theory a little bit. What we should really be doing is writing M here, in which case we have to then say that if M is equal, M naught was equal to M minus delta M, so then we would have had here plus delta M psi bar psi. And so the split between perturbed and unperturbed is not, strictly speaking, just the split between quadratic and cubic terms in the Lagrangian. We have to be more careful about what the parameters are in the unperturbed Lagrangian. And so I'm going to come back to this in more detail later on. But this is an issue which is a conceptual issue independent of divergences. But it's also going to be the thing that starts to absorb divergences, because this is an example of what we would call a counterterm. And it has to be there just on, if you think about, if you're careful about setting up perturbation theory. And so when I come back to it, I want you to be ready for the thought that the split between the unperturbed and the interacting Lagrangian is something which you have to be fairly precise about, and we haven't been yet. But before coming back to that, I want to just talk about divergences, because that's going to be why we're going to come back to this, even though this is conceptually an independent issue from divergences. So what I'd like to do is just say, if we look at some random graph with some arbitrary number of external lines, what's the systematically, how do the E's appear? So, because the thing that's supposed to be justifying perturbation for us is that this E is a small number. And so one thing you'd like to know is in any particular process, how do the E's appear? Because that'll tell you which graphs to include and which graphs not to include. And the lesson there will be that loops are counted by E, but it's important when you're counting the powers of E to also count the powers of 2 pi, because the thing that will really be counting suppressing higher order graphs won't just be E, it'll be E times factors of 2 pi. And so the quality of the perturbation theory is going to be better than it would look if you just asked how big E is. Numerically, in quantum electrodynamics, the charge of the electron is 0.3. And so you might have thought a series in 0.3 is a pretty crappy series. But it turns out that the series you're really doing is an E squared over 16 pi squared. And so that's a much better series. So that'll be the first thing. Second thing will then be, if we take an arbitrary graph, we can ask, how does it diverge? And so when do we expect to get divergences in general for these graphs? And you'll see that it's not in an arbitrary way. So So only some graphs will diverge in quantum electrodynamics. But I'll do that in a slightly broader framework than just quantum electrodynamics, so you can kind of see what would happen differently if we had not been doing quantum electrodynamics. So that's where I'm going. So I want to take a general graph and first count where the e's and 2 pi's go using these Feynman rules, and second, to ask how graphs diverge. So first part of that is, for a general graph, so that'll have, say, E, you know, external electron lines. And let's say E gamma external photon lines. And we'll have also, I guess, E, you know, I, E internal lines. Gamma internal photon lines and V vertices. In quantum electrodynamics, we only have one type of vertex. It's the thing, you know, it's the thing here, which has, it joins one photon to two electrons. So an arbitrary graph with this many lines coming out. So we have all together E gamma photon lines and E electron lines. And arbitrary things going on inside here is what we want to look at. And what I want to do is I want to follow the E's and the 2 pi's. So where do we get an E? We get an E, it's really easy. We get an E for each vertex. So we're going to get whatever the amplitude is for this graph. It's going to be proportional to E to the number of vertices. And the 2 pi's we can also follow because we're going to have every propagator is going to give us a 1 over 2 pi to the fourth. Every vertex will give us a 2 pi to the fourth. And then the only other place you get 2 pi's is when you start doing integrals over momenta. So we'll get a 1 over 2 pi to the fourth to the number of internal lines, internal electron lines plus internal photon lines. And then we'll have 2 pi to the fourth times the number of vertices. And then any integral we actually did, remember, so every internal line we have an integral d for momentum that goes with it. In principle, there's an integral d for p appearing for every internal line. But at every vertex, we have a delta function conserving momentum, which does some of these momentum integrals. And the total number of momentum integrals that are actually left to do as honest-to-God integrals that are not done by these delta functions will be given by, we'll have one for every internal line minus one for every vertex. But we know that at the end of the day, the whole amplitude will be proportional to an overall delta function expressing conservation momentum for the whole vertex. So one combination of these delta functions won't do an integral because it'll be the thing that's left over. It doesn't depend on these internal line momenta, it only depends on external line momenta, and especially momentum conservation. So let's say that if P is the number of integrals to be done. So that's the number of integrals of internal lines that were not done by delta functions. We're going to have a factor of integral d4k, you know, morally speaking, to the p power. I'm telling you that because I want to follow, there's some 2 pi's that come from this, remember? Because when we did this in dimensional regularization, this integral is partly an integral over the magnitude of k, and it's roughly k cubed dk. But there's also integrals over the angles, which came down to an integral of the size of a three sphere. And so this, if I'm counting pi's, is essentially, we got a factor of 2 pi squared when we did dimensional regularization for the directions of a three sphere times integrals when we're counting how things diverge, we should think of this as being an integral like k cubed dk. So for the purposes of counting two pi's, we should expect that every integral that we end up doing is going to give us a factor 2 pi squared. So what I'll do is I'll write here 2 pi squared to the p. So we need to know how p is related to these other things, like v and I, and so on. So what is p? P will be equal to, well, we have one integral. We do an integral for every internal line. So there'll be an IE plus I gamma. But then every delta function does an integral. So we'll have and we have a delta function for every vertex. So we should we should subtract the number of vertices we have. But one vertex doesn't count because one delta function doesn't do an integral over virtual momenta because it is actually the overall momentum conservation delta function that depends only on the external momenta. So we should have to add back here one that doesn't change our number of integrals. So this is actually what you would define to be the number of loops for a graph. The reason for that is that if you imagine drawing some graph in a plane, you know, with a bunch of lines in it, there's a topological identity for anything like this that looks like a disk, which says that the Euler number of a disk, which happens to be 1, it's equal to the sum of the faces here, which I'll call the number of loops, minus the number of edges here, which would be the number of internal lines. Plus the number of vertices. And here I haven't restricted myself to trilinear vertices because it's what I'm saying here is actually true for general kinds of vertices. So what you would have meant by the number of loops here is the number of faces, essentially. And if you draw any graph like this that's on a plane, you'll always find that the number of faces minus the number of edges plus the number of vertices is always the same. It's always equal to 1. No matter how you slice a graph like that, that's this Euler. That's because it's a topological invariant. You can draw graphs that you can't draw on a plane. You could imagine drawing a graph where I connect this line to this line, but it doesn't connect to this line, so it kind of goes underneath it. Say, that would be a graph that's not drawn on a plane. And in that case, I would use this as a definition of what I mean by the number of loops. Then it's kind of not less obvious what you mean by the number of loops, and this will be how we'll define it. So for any graph, this particular combination is what we'll call number of loops. And so you can kind of see that if I solve for L here, L will be 1 plus the sum of the number of internal lines minus the number of vertices. And so that's what I've written here. So P is really the number of loops. That's how many integrals you have to do. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to trade the I's and the V for things that don't depend on, I'd rather express this in terms of the number of external lines rather than the number of internal lines, because for any particular process, if you're doing competent scattering or something, so you knew how many external lines you had there. So if competent scattering was a process where you had electron in, electron out, photon in, photon out, and lots of things could have been happening inside, depending on what graph you were drawing. So the process is specified by the number of external lines. What I'd like to do is I'd like to trade these E's and the V's for the number of external lines. And so I can use that to do that. I can use this to do that, but I'll do that with the penalty that I'll get an answer which depends on the number of loops, but I'll live with that. So I can use this to remove one of V or the sum of the number of internal lines. There's another identity I can use that relates the number of internal lines to the number of external lines. And that is what you could call conservation of ends. So if I take any graph, there's two ways to count the ends of the number of ends you have to a line. One is that every internal line has two ends and every external line has one end. And the other way is that every vertex has a certain number of ends. So in our examples here, we know that the number of ends will be the number of external lines. In fact, we can do this separately for photons and electrons probably, but I probably don't need to do that. So let's just try this in general. So this is the number of ends. Every external line has one end. Every internal line has two. And that has to be equal to what I would have gotten if I'd been counting the ends based on the vertices. And every vertex has three ends to it, right? So that's going to be 3 times b. So this is a way I can eliminate v in terms of, this is another relationship between v and the sum of internal lines. And between these two, I can eliminate v and the sum in terms of l and external lines. So what I'd like to do is to use that to re-express. Let's just do that. So eliminate V and IE plus I gamma. And so let me just, I won't be able to do this in my head without screwing it up, so let me just write it down and then. So I would claim that the number of vertices is number of external lines. Plus 2L minus 2. So to get that, I would have had to take, so I've got 3V here, I've got V here. What I'd like to do is multiply this one by, so here I've got twice this. If I take this and multiply it by 2 and subtract them, then that'll give me something involving V, right? So if I take, I'll have a 2V here. So let me put this on the other side. I'd have a 2V here. I'm subtracting 3V from 2V, I'll get V. I'll have the 2i that goes along for the ride. Now that canceled by the construction, and I'll have this minus nothing else. And that's there. And the 1 is there, I multiplied it by 2, and that's where that came from. And I got a 2 here as well. And if I then solve for ie plus I gamma, that'll be equal to, I'll just quote you the answer, e plus 3L minus 3. So the same thing, if I eliminate V between those two equations, then I'll get this. So, say it again?
The bottom line is, didn't need E, isn't it?
Oh, sorry, I meant to write E, right? Right. This should be. So the point of that exercise is that if we're grouping terms here now, we had a factor of e to the v, I could think of in terms of this stuff. It's an e to the number of external lines. And there's also then a factor of e squared e to the 2l minus 2. And then we have the 2 pi's. We had a 2 pi to the fourth. We had it to the number of v's. We had it to the v minus ie minus I gamma. So that factor we can write as, that's actually directly here, right? V minus the sum of the i's is equal to 1 minus l. So if I group all the factors there, then I'll give them another board. So altogether what we have is we have a power of E that depends on the number of external lines and nothing else. So that'll be the E. Then we have a piece which depends on minus 2, and then we have an e to the 2l. And then the two pi factors, we have 2 pi to the 4th to the 1 minus l. But then the thing coming from the number of these integrations here, this factor here, we also had a 2 pi squared for every loop coming from doing the integrals, the angular part of the integrals. So these things, I pull out the two, let me pull out the one over the overall 2 pi to the 4th here. I don't have to count that one anymore. And you can kind of see if I fix the number of external lines, then everything here doesn't change. The only thing that's changing graph by graph is depending on the number of loops. And it's depending on the number of loops in the way that it's e squared divided. So it's 2 pi squared divided by 2 pi to the 4th would be 8 pi squared. The number of loops. So that shows you, A, that it's the loops that are being counted by the small thing. And it shows you, B, that the thing that's suppressing each loop is not just powers of E. It's powers of E, systematic powers of E divided by 8 pi squared. So So when you did Compton scattering in the first assignment, you did tree graphs. And the reason you did tree graphs, even though there's more than one graph, was that those were all the same size. And if you wanted the first correction of that, that what you would do is one loop graphs with the same number of external lines. But you have to include all one loop graphs, and they would all be the same, involve the same numbers of E. So loops are what's important in the reason that loops are important is that they are the thing that's being counted by the small thing in your problem. But the other good thing is that the small thing in your problem isn't what you thought it was. It's not just E. It's E divided by 8 pi squared. So E squared over 8 pi squared is the small thing. It has to be much less than 1. You know, you write this in terms of alpha. The fine structure constant would have been E squared over 4 pi. So if you write the alpha as being E squared over 4 pi, you can see that what we're using here, what the expansion parameters really is alpha over 2 pi. And so although numerically E is something like 0.3 for an electron, and so that doesn't look like it's such a great series, this is actually a much better series. This is something more like 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3, because it's really the 8 pi's that are doing it all for you. And so so even though the loop expansion is actually very good, so that's the E in the 2 pi counting story. That's it's always good when someone hands you a theory, you want to know what suppresses the graphs that you're not doing, so you know which ones not to do. So you want to know both these things, that it's loops, and that the thing that's suppressing them is a particular combination of your couplings and 2 pi. So now I'd like to kind of do the same kind of story and ask how divergent are, if I take one of these graphs that involves many, many loops, even though it's suppressed by powers of E squared, it also might diverge very badly. So what I wanted to know is repeat the same argument and ask what happens. You know, all we did here was count the 2 pi's and E's, but if we could have counted every integral, we know we have an integral for every loop, basically. But we know that every vertex is giving us, could be giving us powers of momenta if we had momentum-dependent vertices. It doesn't in our case here. Every propagator gives us an inverse power of momentum or momentum squared, depending if we're talking about an electron or a photon. And so we can repeat this argument and ask, just on dimensional grounds, when do we expect the integrals to be diverging or not in the ultraviolet? So let's calculate the, we're going to ask, what is the superficial degree of divergence? Generic graph. So by superficial degree of divergence, I mean exactly what I did last class, where at one loop we had some integral, which was integral, you know, we had, at one loop we had something like integral d4k, then we had some powers of momenta in the numerator, and we had some denominators, which were things like k squared plus m squared to b. And in this case, what we said was that this thing, actually, I guess we did this in n dimensions. And then we said on dimensional grounds, this thing goes like, you know, we have, if we imagine asking how it depends on the largest scale in the problem, we expected it to go like n plus 2a minus 2b. Just because for large k, when k is bigger than m, then all we have are powers of k here. And there's angular factors coming from the angular integrals, but if we think of this as being k to the n minus 1 dk, then you can kind of see if this thing's diverging or not just by counting the powers of momentum. So this is what I was calling the superficial degree of divergence before. And so what I'd like to do in a general graph, the only difference for general graph is that you'll have more than one integral. So you'll have many integrals. You'll have many powers of momenta in the numerator and in the denominator. And in principle, it's a multidimensional integral. You have to worry that sub-integrals will diverge, and then those things could change how the outer integrals diverge. But there's a theorem going on behind the board that makes this superficial degree of divergence. I'm going to just do the naive thing and just count the powers of the momentum as if it was a one-dimensional integral. And there's a theorem going on behind the board called Weinberg's theorem, which is essentially why that's true. It just shows you that if you're careful about the limits of subintegrals, that this naive power counting, just on dimensional grounds, is capturing the right story. So what I want to do is just essentially count the number of integrals we're going to do for a generic graph, and the numbers of powers of momenta, and the numbers of powers of momenta coming from propagators. So this is what we had for one loop. So in general, what we'll do is I'd like to do this in a slightly more general context than quantum electrodynamics, just because first of all, it's easy to do, and secondly, the answer is instructive. So let's imagine that we have many types of fields. So that means that we'll have some label I. So that could be electrons and photons or whatever you like. And so that means that the number of external lines will have to come with a label for each kind of field. And the same thing for the number of internal lines. And we'll imagine we have all kinds of interactions too. So many kinds of vertices. So in quantum electrodynamics, we had just the one type with two electrons and one photon. But let's imagine that we're doing something more general. So each vertex, we can imagine, brings together different numbers of these particles. So let's say it connects L sub I lines of type I. And let's also suppose it involves d derivatives. So because we're going to be interested in counting the powers of momentum in the numerator and denominator, we're going to want to know how many derivatives there are in an interaction. And for quantum electrodynamics, this was zero because we had only two fermion fields and a gauge field and no derivatives. And this was two for the electron type and one for photon type. But we can just carry these things more generally. And let's also imagine that the propagators for these types of fields for large momentum, let's imagine it goes like 1 over p to the 2s. So for photons, s would have been 1. And for scalar fields, if something going like 1 over p squared, for spin a half particles, s would be a half. So things go like 1 over p. And so s will be just some property of the particles that we could be talking about. E.g., S would be a half for fermions. It could be 1 for scalars, and so on. So we can handle them all just by keeping S around. Now, what we want to do is using these rules, count the number of d4p's we have in our integrals. The powers of momenta we're going to get from the integrals coming from each vertex, and the powers of inverse powers of momenta coming from each propagator, and ask how do various graphs diverge given those choices. Go to that board over there, probably. Okay, so how many factors of momentum and integrals over momentum in a generic graph? What we should be getting is we're going to get an integral. So each actual integral that we do will be an integral d4p. So we get one for every loop. So one for every loop for the argument I gave over there that. We get one of these for every internal line. We lose one for every vertex because of the delta function, but there's an overall momentum conserving delta function that doesn't do an integral. So we have one of these for number of internal lines minus the number of vertices plus one, and that's what we mean by the number of loops. And each vertex will give us a p to the, for every vertex, we're going to get some number of derivatives. So we'll get p to the sum over all vertices, number of derivatives times the number of vertices. Take each vertex type, we multiply it by the number of derivatives in that vertex, and that'll be the total power of momentum we're going to get in the numerator from the vertices. And for each internal line, actually, I guess I shouldn't do the sum. I'm saying each vertex gives us this, and so when we sum over the vertices, we'll get the product of this. So each internal line will give us 1 over p to the 2si, because we're assuming that the propagators go like 1 over p to the 2si for large p. So altogether, if I count the powers of momenta, that's what I mean by the superficial degree of divergence. So what we're going to get is a superficial degree of divergence. We'll get 4 times the number of loops. And I'll write the number of loops out. So 4 times, I have every internal line counts here, right? So we'll have sum over internal lines minus sum over the over the vertices plus 1. And that's what I was saying I meant by the number of loops. And then we have sum over all the vertices of dn times the number of vertices. Then we have minus sum over all internal lines of USI times the number of internal lines. Is that right? Let me just check that I haven't lied to you. I missed something here. I'm defined S in a way. In my notes, I define this to be 2, 1 plus S. Don't know why I did that, but 1 minus S. Lied you again. That was the definition I had. So in that case, S would be 0 for the scalar, say, but for spin a half, this would still be a half. So if I chase that through here, then this should be 2, 1 minus s. So what I'll get here is I'll get 2 So I want to use the same notation I used in my notes here, otherwise I'll never get anything right. All right, so I got sum of I 2 minus 2s. Good. All right, so again, I'd like to be able to trade. Number of internal lines is not so useful to have, but let me first, I guess, group terms. So let's group the things that involve no sum. So I got a 4. That's it, right? I'll write that 4 separately. If I take the things that are sums over i's, I got plus sum over I of 4 minus 2 plus 2 si. And the things involving sum over n, I'm going to get a minus 4 plus e. All right, so all I've just now is I've just grouped terms, grouped the sums in a particular way. What I'd like to do now is eliminate I using one of our identities. And the identity I want to use is conservation of n's again. So conservation of n's. It says that every internal line, so that if I sum over all the internal lines and multiply that by 2, twice the number of internal lines plus the number of external lines is the number of n's of particle type I. And that has to be equal to the total number of lines that meet at a vertex. And so that would be sum over all vertices. And then the number of the lines of type I that meet at a vertex, I'm calling L here. So let's call that that. Also by. I should probably label this with the N labels the vertex we're talking about, and then the I labels the kinds of particles we're talking about joining at that vertex. No, you're right. It's true I by I. Exactly. Thanks. So I can solve this for I is the point. So let me that'll allow me to trade I for vertices, which we have already. So I can this is I is equal to 1/2 So minus pi plus sum over n vn ln. Make sure that I'm agreeing with myself here. Yeah, okay, so far so good. So let me just to use that in here. So D is 4 plus sum over I of 2, 1 plus SI. Then I can use this. So I have a half times minus E. And I can carry the other thing along for a ride. So I sum over n right, so the half picks up the 2. And what I can do is I can group things again. And what I like to do is I want to group things involving the n's separately from the things involving the i's. So says, so let me group, keep the E here because that doesn't depend on any V's. So I've got 4 minus sum over I of 1 plus S times E. So that's this thing here, right? And then we have this thing involving sum over N, V sub N times we have dn minus 4, and here we have plus sum over I 1 plus si o I n. So let me just call this whole thing delta n. Let me call this minus delta n. 4 minus d minus sum of and we got 4 plus the sum of minus right. Good. Actually that's right. So now here's the interesting thing. Okay, so what's nice is that things here depend on the details of the vertices. Nothing here does at all. So if you had a theory, so delta n here, let me write this as minus delta n, where delta n is 4 minus d minus sum over I 1 plus s of I. So what are we looking for here? What we're thinking is that if d is greater than or equal to 0, that's something which is diverging, right? And if d is negative, then that would be something which is converging. Superficially speaking. So we're interested in when d is when d can be negative. Now, so there's two cases. So the two cases are if delta, if you take all your vertices in your problem, if delta is ever negative. I think I've got a sign coming here. What's 4 minus b? Oh, yeah, right. No, I'm good. So theories are going to divide up into two classes. So if your theory has the property that all these deltas are non-negative, so if it happens that delta is, let's take case one. Let's take the case that delta n is actually not true, where the delta n is less than zero for some n. Then it doesn't make any difference what this factor is here. If delta is negative, then I can make, by adding more and more of those vertices, I can make this more and more positive. And that means that I'm making it more and more divergent. So for any number of fixed external lines, you choose your process. I can always find a graph which uses the vertex for which delta is negative sufficiently often that this graph is going to eventually diverge. So in this case, if there exists an interaction for which this is true, then any process, that means for any external lines, some graph. So those are what we mean by non-renormalizable theories. That's what we call non-renormalizable. That means that it's always possible for any process to make any process diverge, no matter what the process is. But if it's true that for all the vertices in your problem, that these deltas are non-negative, then if the delta is non-negative, then this always reduces d. So that means that whether or not d will be negative or positive is going to be controlled by this thing, which depends only on the external lines and the kinds of fields you have. And the more external lines you have, the more negative this is. So if you have enough external lines, what will happen is that this will be negative and things will converge, and then adding more interactions will just make it converge even more. So what will happen in the case that the deltas are non-negative is that for small numbers of these external lines, you can get things that are diverging. But if you have enough external lines, things are all going to converge no matter how many insertions of the interactions you have. And so that means only a specific kind of graph will be diverging. It'll be one for which there's a small number of external lines. So if delta n is bigger than or equal to zero for all n, then d will be less than zero except for a small number, except for processes with the EI sufficiently small. So the quantum electrodynamics is an example of, so this is what we would call a renormalizable theory. The idea is that since there's only specifically a specific number of things that are diverging, there's only some specific number of parameters that you need to absorb the divergences into, and once you've done that, they're gone. So the key thing will be whether or not you have, you know, the, what for your particular theory, what delta is. And you kind of see the kind of thing that makes, you'd like delta to be positive. And delta starts off being 4, but then the more derivatives you have, the more negative delta becomes. The more lines you have combining at a vertex, the more negative delta becomes. And so having delta never be negative is something which will be very restrictive in the kinds of interactions you can have. It'll have an, it'll force an upper limit to how many derivatives you can have, and it'll force a number, an upper limit to the number of fields that can meet in any one vertex. And so what we're expecting is that most theories will be in case one, and that some specific kinds of theories will be in case two, and those will be very predictive theories, those ones that are in case two. Okay, so let me take let's now go back to quantum electrodynamics. So for quantum electrodynamics, what do we have? We have two kinds of, you know, we have external lines, electron external lines, and we have photon external lines. So the index I went over electron and photon. We knew that the propagator here goes like 1 over p, and so s for an electron was 1/2. Propagator for the photon went like 1 over p squared, so s for the photon was 0. What else do we have to know? We have to know, well, we have only one kind of vertex. And for it, the number of derivatives was 0. And it involves it brings together two electron lines, and it brings together, you know, one photon line. So if we ask, you know, what delta would be, so delta for this vertex would be 4 minus the number of derivatives, which is 0, minus, you know, 1 plus s electron times the number of electron lines, 1 plus s photon times the number of photon lines. So you see it's equal to 4. So s electron was 1/2, so this is 3/2 times the number of electron lines, which is 2. That's 3. And here we had s photon was 0, and l photon was 1, and so this is just minus 1. So delta 0 in this case, so it's an example for which delta is, there's no deltas, there's no vertices for which delta is negative. We're talking about case 2. And for this case, then D becomes, because delta is 0, D doesn't depend on the number of vertices. It only depends on, it's 4 minus sum over, it'll be 1 plus s electron times the number of electron lines, minus 1 plus s photon times the number of photon external lines. And so that's 4. So this is, again, 3/2 times the electron line. At 0, so this is now minus the number of photon lines. So now we can go through all the possible cases that would make D, allow D to be positive. So what can we do? We have to have at least some external lines, and if we have a fermion, Lorentz conservation requires that if we have one electron line, we have two, because the electron line coming in has to come out. So Lorentz invariance, or conservation of fermion number, if you like, we have, we can take the case where I guess the same thing's true for the photon, right? If you can't have three photons, That's not right. If we have no electrons, then we have to have an even number of photons too. But if we have electrons, we can have an odd number of photons. So what are the cases? We can have E equals zero. And then we could have D will be non-negative, provided that there we have four or less photons, right? We have E gamma equals two. We're going to have E equals zero. E gamma equals four. This would have D equals two. We would have D equals four, zero. We have EE equals 2, then this makes this 4 minus 3 is 1. So then we only have the choice that E gamma is equal to 0 or 1. Right, so we have that would have D equals 1. And that's it, right? And I didn't allow myself to have an odd number of photons if I had no electrons, because Lorentz invariance also did that. So that's actually very specific. That says that this is a process like electron. We have a process where an electron goes in, an electron comes out, and a photon comes out. This is a process where an electron goes in, electron comes out. This is a process where we have in principle four photons evolve. Here's a process where we have two photons. And those are the things that we can imagine diverging. But we have more information than just this, because you know these amplitudes, in principle, they're functions of the external momenta that are involved. And they could be some complicated function, because there's scattering amplitudes. But the divergent parts of them have very simple momentum dependence, is the next thing I want to argue. So I want to claim that that in the cases where D equals zero, the part that's diverging here is independent of momentum. And if in the cases where D is equal to one or two, then it's a polynomial in momentum. It's a very simple function of momentum. And it's not, so although the answer for any of these graphs could be a complicated function of their external momenta, the divergent part of it is actually a very simple piece of it. And we've already seen that for the vacuum polarization. We evaluated this graph. We found that it did diverge. We found that it diverged, but the divergence was in the constant part of what we were calling pi. And we could always write it as being a constant, which is diverging, plus a function of momentum squared, where the interesting momentum dependence was, which was finite. And so I want to argue that property that we saw already for this graph is more generally true for all these things. And when I write a circle here, I don't mean electron line. I just mean there's some graph that we haven't said what it is. It's some process. Yeah.
Self-energy of the electron. I could start adding photons to the legs.
Yeah.
And increasing the gamma. But I'm guessing it wouldn't change the UV divergence of the graph.
So you're thinking if I start adding photons up here or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. So the if things converged using this criterion of superficial degree of divergence, it's the reason it's called superficial is things like this. That if you draw a graph, subgraphs can diverge even if the superficial degree of divergence says it's not diverging. So for example. So let me, we can do some examples where you can kind of see it happening explicitly. So if you take some process like, and we know that this graph does diverge. So if I take a process like something which should be, so this kind of thing is supposed to be convergent. But if in particular I looked at this particular graph, this subgraph is going to diverge, because we know this graph diverges, even though this whole thing has a superficial degree of divergence which says it's converging. So the more precise statement would be that this superficial degree of divergence doesn't mean that you're going to be guaranteed the graph diverges or converges. If D is negative, the graph may still diverge because there's a subgraph in it that's diverging, say. But the main thing it's telling you is that there's not a new primitive divergence associated with this kind of external line, but all the divergences you are getting are coming from subgraphs that you've already understood on that list over there. So what will happen is that if we have a counterterm, which we're going to end up getting, which we have to add to absorb this divergence, then if we have this graph, we'll also have a graph where we have the counterterm in here. And what will happen is that these divergences will systematically take care of each other once you've solved them in this case, and they're not an additional problem for these things with different numbers of external lines. Whereas if we had the case one, the non-normalizable case, even if you'd done this for the subgraphs, then each new combination of external lines will have a primitive divergence that you have to deal with a new counterterm for it. And that's the thing that's not happening in these normalizable cases. Okay, so to close off the thought, what I want to do is I want to argue that that when you have a graph that's divergent in this way, it's diverging. It's the momentum dependence of the divergent part is very simple. It's some polynomial momentum, and the argument for that is actually really simple. Where's the best place to do it? The claim is that the divergent of a graph with D between 0 just depends on the external momenta on polynomial. And the easiest way to think about what's going on is just to think about any particular graph. So if we took a graph, if you had something like this, where we had some loop momentum L, some incoming momentum P, let's say, this must have been P plus L. This gave us something which was, let's imagine we're doing this for scalars. Just so we don't have to talk about Fermion propagators. Then, we're going to get here something like integral d4L, and we'll get some vertices and things. But if I follow the propagators, we're going to have a 1 over, L squared plus some mass squared minus I epsilon from this line. And then we'll get some other propagator, which is 1 over L minus, I guess, L plus P squared plus M squared minus I epsilon times other factors. And the observation is that the external momenta generically are appearing in the denominators here. So if you differentiate with respect to the external momenta, what you typically would do is if I differentiate this with respect to p squared here, what will happen is that I'm going to pull down another factor of this propagator. I'll get, if I differentiate 1 over this, I'm going to get 1 over this squared, essentially, times the derivative of the denominator. And so every time I differentiate the answer with respect to the external momenta, I get a more convergent integral. So if this thing had been the one I originally wrote down here, if this was really the whole answer, so this was logarithmically divergent, so they have 4 powers of L in the numerator, 4 powers of L in the denominator for large L. If I differentiate this with respect to P squared once, what I'm going to get is something involving 6 powers of L in the denominator, because I'm going to get another factor of 1 over L squared plus P squared differentiating this term. And so that'll be something that converges. So that would show you that that whatever the answer was here that was diverging, it would have had to have been something independent of the external momenta, because if I differentiate with the external momenta, I get something which is converging. And so the amplitude for this process would have been, as a function of the external momentum, would have been a constant piece, which is diverging, plus a finite piece, which is finite. So all the complicated p squared dependence could be arbitrarily complicated, but it's in the finite part, and the thing that's diverging is really some overall constant. If this had been, if we'd only had one factor here, so this had been something which is diverging quadratically, then if I differentiate it once, I would be getting something which is now converging logarithmically. So I'd have to differentiate twice to make it be finite. So that would tell me that in that case, if I had a quadratically diverging quantity, then the divergence didn't have to be independent of momentum, but it could at most be quadratic in momentum. So if I could then have something which is, something proportional to p squared, something independent of p squared, but anything more complicated than that had to be something which was going to be finite. So what you can do in these cases is you can kind of read off that so in this case, this is something which looks like it could be diverging quadratically. So that says that we could have had something here which went like, if we have indices mu and nu here, we could have had something like a to mu nu times a quadratic coefficient c1, which is diverging. And we could have had things involving momenta. So we could have had something like a to mu nu times p squared times some coefficient c2. Or we could have had a term like p mu p nu times c3, which could have been diverging. But then whatever was left had to be finite. Now, when we actually evaluated this, we found that gauge invariance forbade this thing. So we didn't get this at all. And gauge invariance said that these two things were actually related to one another. We had this minus this. And so once we're done, this thing was diverging logarithmically. But the momentum dependence was a polynomial, like it had to be. And then we had something finite. If we did the similar story here, this is something which, if this diverges at all, it has to be something which is the constant piece which is diverging, because this kind of thing will diverge at most logarithmically. And so you could imagine something like this is mu, nu, lambda, rho. We'll have some tensor which is completely symmetric in the interchange of these things, eta mu, nu, eta lambda, rho, eta mu, lambda, eta nu, rho, let's say, times some coefficient c4. But in the same way that gauge invariance forces us to have specific momentum dependence here, gauge invariance also forces us to have a certain amount of momentum dependence here. So it turns out that gauge invariance forbids this term. And so this actually turns out to be finite in quantum electrodynamics. If you actually calculate it, it converges. And so that's just because none of the arguments I've been making have been building in gauge invariance. Okay, so gauge invariance is an additional constraint above everything I've said. And so it's kind of forcing the momentum dependence to come in a particular way because the bosons involved here, have a particular symmetry. And so things in this two cases are diverging less badly than they could have been diverging because gauge invariance is forbidding some of the things that could have been diverging. But if you had regulated the vacuum polarization, for example, using a cutoff, which is not, and you, whenever you use a cutoff, you're breaking gauge invariance, then you would have found, as they did in the 50s, that you do get things like this, which would be a contribution to the photon mass, let's say. And it's just a complete artifact of the fact that you broke gauge invariance. So one of the nice things about dimensional regularization is that it makes it all explicit. You don't have to think about this. You actually get the things that are diverging, and you would have found this to be finite just from the get-go, and so on. This kind of thing here, so something involving two fermions and as linearly diverging, you could have imagined that could have been something times C5, let's say, times a unit matrix in spin space. Or you could have had C6 times C slash would be something which is linear in momenta. This is something which you could imagine being linearly divergent. And this is something which you could imagine being logarithmically divergent. But then that's it. After that, it has to be finite. And this thing here is something where we could have had C7 times gamma mu. It had to have an index mu and then two spinner indices. But it's only logarithmic divergence, so that means that only a constant piece can possibly survive. If we differentiate it with respect to any momenta at all, it'll give us something finite. And so that shows us that the kinds of things that we can imagine being divergent are are things that you're going to recognize. So if you wrote pi mu nu for the thing involving two external lines, then gauge invariance is saying, if we build in that gauge invariance, tells us that this has to come in the combination. This is what we actually found when we did this calculation. If we look at the thing involving just fermions in the external lines, then we're going to get, let's call that sigma for self-energy. This has to be something which is a, let me have the fermion lines go that way. It's something which will have two Dirac indices in it. So it's a matrix in Dirac space. But it could also be a function of momentum. And so that could be, it'll be C phi times, say, delta Mn plus C6 times P slash Mn plus the finite piece. And then the vertex part would be let's call that lambda mu m n. That would be C7 times mu m plus some finite piece. So you won't be surprised to, so this thing that the only way this thing can diverge is the way that the electric charge appeared in our basic vertex. So we're going to be able to absorb this divergence into the value of the electric charge. These are the kind of things that appear in the free part of the Lagrangian. So this is the kind of thing that this is like a mass. This is like the P slash term in the inverse propagator for the fermion. And this is like the mass term, and this is like the Fv nu term in the Lagrangian. And so what this will correspond to is we're going to be able to absorb this into a wave function, just a rescaling of the fermionic field. And we absorb this into a shift of the mass of the fermionic field, which I've argued we have to do anyway, because if you're doing perturbation theory, the mass of the unperturbed thing has to be the real physical mass of the problem. And then this is the thing we're going to be able to absorb into the normalization of the electromagnetic field. And so the special feature of this being normalizable is that there's only specific things that are diverging, and the things that are diverging are specifically depending on momentum in exactly the way terms in the Lagrangian did. And so that means that we're going to always be able to, if we're careful about organizing our perturbation theory, we're going to always be able to cancel the divergences that we find in coefficients in the Lagrangian. And so the last thing I want to do is write that last thing down. So if we what I want to do is go back to the thing that I hope I didn't erase already. I might have erased it, actually. So I made the argument that we had taken an unperturbed Lagrangian, and we took the QED Lagrangian and we wrote it as an unperturbed and a perturbed part. So we said it was L naught plus L interaction. And naively, what we did is we said that L naught was minus 1/4. Fv nu minus psi bar d slash plus m psi. And naively, L interaction was the minus ie psi bar a slash psi. And that was the wrong thing. Independent of this divergence story, this was the wrong thing to do. What we should really have been doing is writing the zeroth order part to be the free theory using fields for which the kinetic terms are canonically normalized, including the corrections and powers of E, and involving the mass, which is the physical mass of the particle, including the interactions. And so there are terms that we're keeping in L naught here, which we should not be keeping in L naught. They should actually be moved to the interaction piece, because the M that's appearing here is not really the physical mass. This parameter in the Lagrangian is the first term in the expression for the physical mass, but there are corrections to it. And so what we should be expanding around is the free theory of a particle with the honest-to-God physical full mass, including the fractions. So what we'll do is we'll do two things. We'll write M as being, let's write knots everywhere here just to distinguish that these fields have not been canonically normalized yet, and then M naught is not really the physical mass yet. And I'll write E naught here because E naught is not yet the physical E that you would measure in Coulomb scattering or in some physical way. It's just a parameter that is related to the physical charge, but there'll be corrections in powers of E naught between the physical charge that you would mean, such as the coefficient of the Coulomb law, and this parameter. So what we want to do is make explicit the connection between E and M and the physical thing. So what we'll do is write A naught mu as being some thing. It'd be great if you could mute the sound in Guelph, guys. It sounds like you're tearing up huge pieces of paper.
No, I just put my jacket on.
Oh, okay. It sounds like you're hosing down something with a fire hose.
Maybe the microphone is very sensitive. I'm not sure.
Yeah, if it has a mute button, that would be great.
I'll try not to move.
Okay, that's good. All right, so I want to just make sure that I use the right notation here. So I'm just about done here. I just want to call it the same thing I called it in my notes. Because these names are historically, they've been entrenched and codified over the years, and I want to give you the ones that people actually really use. Here we go. All right, so we'll call this Z3. So the canonically normalized field I'm going to have with no subscripts, but it's not the one we started off with, is the main message. And we'll have a same thing for the fermion, and we'll write that as being Z2 the half times the fermionic field. And then we'll write M naught as being physical mass with delta M. I guess we have a choice as to whether which way we write the delta M there. I'm going to actually write it. I'll write it with that convention for time, sign. Then E naught, what I'm going to do is I'm going to call that, I want to call it Z1, but for now, for reasons that will become clear in a second, it's going to be convenient to put some factors here. So these parameters are just normalizations of, it's just a way of saying that this is proportional to the real physical charge, and the fields are proportional to the real physical fields. And the point of doing that will be, what we'll do now is we'll write the free Lagrangian in terms of the physical mass and the physical fields, and then the difference between the physical fields involving these Zs, the difference between Z and 1, we'll call that a perturbation, and we'll put that in the interaction part of the Lagrangian. So let me just close off with that. So our Lagrangian, which was minus 1/4 f naught mu, minus psi bar naught d slash si, let's see, d slash plus m naught. Just put those definitions in, we're going to get a factor. We're going to get minus 1/4 Z3 FB nu. We'll get minus Z2 psi bar E slash plus, then M naught was M minus delta M psi. And then we got minus IE C1. Now, in principle, we would have had a Z2 inverse z3 to the minus 1 half, but then that's exactly designed to cancel the factor of z2 I'm going to get from the psi naught squared and the z3 to the 1 half here. So that's why that, that's why these extra factors were included just so that they would go away when I wrote this term down. So now I want to write this as L naught plus L interaction. What we'll do is we'll have L naught is now minus 1 fourth. It's what we want. It's what we've been choosing right along. But now this M is the honest to God physical mass, including the radiative corrections, and everybody is canonically normalized. And everything that's not here has to be in the interaction term. So, so L interaction will be IE psi bar A slash psi plus what we'll call the counter term Lagrangian. And the counter term Lagrangian is just everything else. So it's just, so we had this and we wanted this, so there must be a piece which is minus 1 fourth E3 minus 1. And then we have minus V2 minus 1 psi bar V slash plus M psi. And we have also minus delta M Z2 psi psi. And we have since I've written this thing explicitly, I just need to subtract that here. So I'll have minus IE Z1 minus 1 psi bar A slash psi. So this is like it was before, except now it's a physical mass. This is like what it was before, but we've added these new counterterms. And these new counterterms are just keeping track of the fact that we've redefined the fields to make the kinetic terms canonical. And we've redefined the mass in terms of the physical mass. And we've redefined the charge in terms of the physical charge. And so these, the Feynman rules for these extra things are exactly the same as what we had for the infinite parts here. So the Feynman rule for this will be the same as that. The Feynman rule for this will be the same as that. The Feynman rule for this will be the same as that. And the Feynman rule for this is the same as that. And so what's the story will be that these divergences we're going to get, we're going to be able to absorb into these coefficients. And then we're gone. And so I want to emphasize that the necessity to do this redefinition, in particular the shifting of the mass, was independent. If everything had been finite, we still would have had to do this, because perturbation theory would not have made sense if we were perturbing around the wrong mass. The way that the Feynman graphs would show you that is if you had some process involving scattering of many particles, and if you looked at a process where you then corrected the mass of some external line, you know, this external line here is on shell, so it satisfies p squared plus m squared equals 0. But if this is really correcting the mass, and you use the bare mass here, not the real physical mass, then what would happen is that this line here, which is a propagator, it'd be 1 over p squared plus m squared, it's being evaluated at p squared equals m squared, and so it would be diverging. And so the requirement of perturbation theory to perturb around the physical mass comes back and bites you. If you say, well, that all sounds very airy-fairy and fancy, if I just do graphs, how do I see a problem? The way you'd be punished for doing the expansion around the wrong mass would be you'd find graphs blowing up on you corresponding to self-energy corrections to the external lines. And that's a way of telling you that perturbation theory is not under control. You know, doing this over and over again, it gets worse and worse and worse, because every time you do it, you get an infinite coefficient corresponding to putting these lines on shell. And that's just showing you that you've lost control of your expansion, or that you thought was being controlled by some small number is actually not being controlled by some small number. And if you trace that back as to why that happened, it's because the whole framework of perturbation theory requires you to be perturbing around the physical mass. And so this necessity to have these counterterms there is not being driven by the divergence of the answer. But given that you're doing it, the good news is that the divergences that you're finding get absorbed into these things. And so this renormalization that you have to do is, you had to be doing it anyway, but it's a good thing in that it also absorbs the divergences that you hit when you do these calculations. So we'll do some examples explicitly in the next class where you can kind of see this work in detail, but this is essentially how renormalization works. So remember to hand in your assignments and to pick up the new assignment if you haven't picked it up already.